Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled. Pixel Sift is proudly supported by the Murdoch University School of Arts. At the School of Arts at Murdoch University, you can learn how to make games, you can learn how to make radio or podcasts, media or video, or you can mix them all together in sort of an interdisciplinary mix of jambalaya and all of that sort of crazy stuff. There's plenty of stuff to choose from, and you can pick units from all over the place. You can learn great stuff with a great university degree, but you also have heaps of fun making cool projects like this one.
Sometimes this is fun.
It's really fun.
It's pretty fun.
It's a great time. Murdoch University School of Arts. You can search Murdoch University if you head to a web browser. Murdoch University School of Arts, proudly supporting Pixel Sift. Pixel Sift. Hello and welcome to Pixel Sift. This week, I am joined by Nick and Mitch, and my name, of course, is Gianni. If you're joining us for the first time, we here at Pixel Sift are a show that explores the issues in gaming, and we also talk to members of the game development industry around the world. And today, we've got a guest from one of our nearest neighbours from Singapore, Ian Gregory, who's joining us from Witching Hour Studios. Ian, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, thanks for having me.
We're really excited to talk a little bit about your game coming up a little bit later.
Remember when we first started this? It's like, we're going to focus on Australia. Let's focus on Australia.
I think
and then we've
Singapore
gone to New Zealand so many times, and now we're in Singapore. Singapore, isn't this great?
New Zealand and Singapore is good feature creep, I think.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Singapore is, you know, it's like such a close country.
Yeah, so I'm not complaining.
Well, it's in the same time zone, at least.
Exactly. We're going to be talking about some other stuff as well, aren't we, Mitch? What else are we checking out?
Yes, so we'll be taking a look at the professional esports on Australian TV. Last month, an Overwatch tournament was broadcast on Channel 7, but was the audience there to watch it?
And finally, with the commercial success of games such as Crash Bandicoot, Insane Trilogy, and Modern Warfare Remastered, is there now a lack of incentive for publishers to take a gamble with new IPs?
Interesting points. Let's jump into it, shall we?
Did you know Pixel Sift is available on other platforms? You can find previous episodes on iTunes, Pocket Casts, YouTube, and on the Pixel Sift website. Okay, so over the past several years, popularity of esports has grown and is raking in the dollars with, you know, with TV stations like ESPN wanting a slice of that pie. Recently, a popular online shooter, Overwatch, was broadcast on Channel 7 right here in Australia. So, were you watching, Johnny?
I did catch it on an on-demand catch-up service.
Yeah, of course you did.
Which is, you know, part of the reason why we're kind of discussing this topic is that a lot of hype was made of it being available now to watch on Australian TV. I don't know what the situation's like in Singapore, Ian, but for us it was kind of an exciting moment to see this esports tournament on normal free-to-air broadcast television, not on a cable network or a sports network, and kind of leaving the realm of online streaming platforms like Twitch and Mixer and YouTube and things like that. So, yeah, it's an interesting sort of thing. But I guess we're wondering whether, you know, they have lots of statistics now where we know young people are increasingly turning off broadcast television. And is this a ploy to bring those people back, and will they come back?
I personally had no idea this was even on standard Australian broadcast. And literally until we said, oh, we should discuss this, I was like, this was on TV? This is on Channel 7? I didn't even know, to be fair. I didn't even know there was a tournament happening in Australia. I watched it later on.
More importantly, we beat Japan.
We beat Japan. We did beat Japan.
Well, congratulations.
Yes. Yeah. No one, I don't think anyone expected. We were like, oh, yeah, Australia's about to get flogged. And then Whoa, what?
Yeah.
So it'd be like the Winter Olympics all over again. Ian, what's the situation like in Singapore? Do you have esports broadcast on TV available for people to watch?
No, not at all, actually. So one of the mistakes that people kind of make is that they think Singapore is very much like South Korea. Sure, we've got the technology, but games have a pretty negative connotation here. So I don't think we're going to see it on our national television anytime soon. I mean, we're a small country. We've only got like, what, 5 channels? So I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. But there is quite a groundswell of esports going on here, and it's popping up all over the place. In fact, I think one thing that we're doing a lot more here is actually conventions where lots of esports are happening.
That's the
so.
Oh, sorry to cut you off, but I noticed when I was there the last time in Singapore, there was a lot of really cool places for players to get together in one space and play games. Like your LAN cafes are like they're insane. Like they're really awesome. They're really bright and they're really clean, and it's generally a great place to be.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that we do very well. Well, because technology is a lot. It's very cheap here in Singapore. So yeah, we've got these great LAN cafes that are functionally arenas. So the funny thing is that we have the infrastructure for like really big things, like the tournaments that you see on TV back over there. But it's not quite happening yet. I think we're dealing with a lot of I guess what I would call social cultural things that we need to deal with before we're going to see something like that in the mainstream.
That was a point that we actually discussed quite a bit, because there was a recent controversy over during a Street Fighter V tournament. One of the players was asked mid-game to change his character's skin because it was deemed inappropriate for broadcast.
And to that I say, has anyone seen Street Fighter V? Like, there's a few revealing outfits in that, and the character he was playing was Cammy, of course, who, you know, is prepared for battle. No,
There's actually a lot of very interesting cultural things. Like, I don't know whether you guys are aware, but in China, you're not allowed to show any kind of exposed bone. So that means you can't have skeletons in games in China.
They're probably not a fan of Mortal Kombat then.
Yeah.
Well, exposed bone is interesting. So they draw the... So what about... I'm not familiar with the actual rules in China, but is it...
It's to do with kind of anything that kind of has sort of like a cult or spiritualism. So anything like zombies are kind of okay. And in World of Warcraft is the famous example where they have this. So the undead characters in that, you know, their elbows and knees kind of pop out of their skin. But in the Chinese version that was done by NetEase, I think, the company that does it for Blizzard, they basically turn them into full zombies and they've got skin and everything. They just look like, you know.
So how does that kind of thing, are there any specific rules that you can think of that affect Singapore in that manner?
Not mostly anything pornographic is a definite no-no, but I think that in Singapore we're dealing with much more fundamental issues and this whole, okay, so we're a very academic driven country, right? So the whole idea of kids playing games just, you know, shuts a lot of things down, and it's only very recently that we're seeing this kind of like groundswell of people going like, you know what, actually it's quite okay, let's play games. And esports is very big in Singapore. But one thing, okay, if you talk about esports, the interesting thing is that, you know, we all do national service. Mm-hmm. And it was a big hoo-ha because many Singaporeans have had the opportunity to represent Singapore in many international competitions, but it couldn't because of national service. So they had to go join the army. And these are kind of conversations we're trying to have here, let alone putting it something on the mainstream.
Are there exceptions for other sports people from national service? Or is it you... go in
it's pretty,
and that's it?
It's pretty blanketed. I think only very recently one of our national swimmers managed to get a deferment of his national service to represent Singapore, and it was the right move because he actually brought home the gold in the Olympics. He beat Michael Phelps.
That's a pretty good claim to fame. I think justified the deferment there.
Yeah, when I was over there earlier this year, that was seemed like all anyone wanted to talk about. And
I think this is a really interesting thing because this sort of online streaming and this type of broadcast, I guess it's television, but it's not really, is an audience that is being captured that is not going to traditional media at all. You said that esports are pretty popular in Singapore. Are people getting online and watching all this stuff in your opinion, Ian?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think in Singapore, the average Singaporean kid, right, very commonly watches plays and replays, and Twitch is very big over here as well. I think with regards to esports, Overwatch is huge, as is Dota. and such. I think one of the biggest problems, I mean, we talk about broadcast, one of the biggest issues about games is that if you don't play the game, you don't know what's going on. And especially where games that move so quick like Overwatch or a game that has so many obscure rules like Dota, an average person, can you imagine your mom sitting down and trying to understand all these like bright lights on a screen? I don't think that's going to happen.
To be fair, though, I've tried to understand American football and I've watched the Super Bowl many times and I couldn't tell you what's going on there.
Yeah, it's so I think barrier of entry is a real issue if broadcast or if any kind of traditional media one really wants to pick up games, because part of it is actually explaining what's going on. And I think that's one of the biggest issues we have as a gamer community, is that we have kind of isolated ourselves from the general public. So until the accessibility is addressed, even if we put it on broadcast or on national television, a lot of people are going to be very flabbergasted about what the hell is going on.
Do are young people in Singapore moving away from broadcast TV as well?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's interesting because technology moves so fast in Singapore. A lot of our broadcast, our national channels, has switched to an on-demand style system. So that means any kind of local production, right? You can watch it anytime already. So we've embraced that whole direction where, you know, HBO, NBC, all the major channels in America are going towards.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand, there is no such thing as free-to-air TV in Singapore, is there? You do need to pay for your TV service in some manner, don't you?
Yeah, but it's a pittance for the national channels.
It's
cable
okay.
that you really got to pay for.
Right.
Here's the thing, right? So you pay for, there's no free broadcast channels, but everything that they show is free on the internet.
Oh, okay.
So it's one of those things where most people don't turn on the televisions. They just stream it from their phones and from their computers, and they're going to be watching exactly the same thing you could watch when you turn the TV on.
Well, look, I think that's a pretty good example of, you know, the way that the audience has moved from a traditional broadcast model onto a new platform, which people who were watching esports had already done. And the audiences are there, they're well prepared, they're seeking this stuff out because it's not just on TV in the background. They actually need to go out and look for these things, and they have the engagement there.
It sounds like they're probably going to, esports might skip broadcast TV altogether, because with the bandwidth that Singapore gets, you get like really awesome internet. And it's, yeah, I think they don't even need to go there. It might not even be a conversation that will ever be had.
It'll be really,
yeah.
The only
reason I think that it would need to go on broadcast is actually for the money and the sponsorship of the games themselves. Because if you think about it, right, esports, unlike normal sports had a very natural, from amateur playing of all the sports to the professional leagues. Esports didn't have that. If you think about it, it's only come up in the last, 5 to 10 years. And it was artificially bolstered by lots of brands and companies who see a future in this business model. So one of the main things is that if they want to take it mainstream, they have to, a lot of money needs to be pumped in to make it mainstream. So make it kind of like the common jargon, like what we see in like basketball and football.
It's going to be really interesting to see what happens with this. You know, there's shrinking margins in Australia, at least, on commercial free-to-air television, whether they're going to make that investment to bring the audiences along and have the content there so that you can, you know, train a new audience in a new type of you know, viewing. It's very interesting. I'm sure there's going to be much more to talk about this, but right now let's jump into our next topic. If you just joined us this week, we are speaking to Ian Gregory. He's the creative director at Witching Hour Studios, a Singaporean-based developer behind Masquerada, Song and Shadows. Yeah. It's, well, maybe Ian, you can explain it to us. We've had a bit of a squiz at the game. What is it and how does it play?
Right. So it's an RPG for today, but it draws a lot from things from the past. So we love games like Neverwinter Nights and Baldur's Gate, and we wanted a much more streamlined idea of how the game could be. So it's a role-playing game, and you control a party, and it's pause and play, so you can pause at any point in time and pace it how you like to play. But the world itself, I think that's kind of like what we're really pushing, is this world where masks are a great source of power. They are artifacts that no one knows how to make anymore, and it gives you the ability to control elemental magic. And it becomes this pivotal item in the world, such that only the very rich can have them. And we explore themes of our rich and poor and the politics of what happens when a city depends on this constantly diminishing resource. Because these masks, if they are on the face of a person who dies, they turn to dust. So it's constantly diminishing. And it plays a very big part in the things that go on in the game.
Now, you're talking a little bit about sort of the attitudes towards games in Singapore. How did this all come together, and how did you decide that you wanted to make a game there?
Well, I think, number one, I am Singaporean through and through, born and bred, very proudly so. And I have always been particularly... I've always been very insulted when people assume that Singaporeans cannot be creative. So I always tell people that as expensive it is to run a studio in Singapore, we do it nearly out of spite just to prove to people that we can. and one thing that really ticked me off is that one of our earliest games, I was showing it to somebody in the States, and they're going like, "Oh, that's very interesting. So your production team's in Singapore. Where's your creative team?" You know, he was just incapable of accepting the idea that a Singaporean, an Asian Singaporean team could do something creative. And I took great offense at that, and that kind of made me put my foot down and go, you know what, I'm going to do something bigger, better, just to say that we can.
I'm offended on your behalf.
And that's what... Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
So rough.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of where it's... So that's kind of where it stemmed from. We started the studio when I was back in school, and I'm a huge D&D. I love playing Dungeons & Dragons. And do you guys play?
I play the old game of Dungeons & Dragons. I'm more of a Pathfinder man myself.
I'm a bit of a Pathfinder guy.
I'm a Hell Dwarf bard. Sorry, guy.
Right.
All right, settle down, Nick.
Well, one of the things about Dungeons and Dragons, and I think Pathfinder kind of suffers this as well, is that once you go past level 9, the magic users become incredibly powerful and really quite fun to play, but the non-magic characters tend to be a little bit more dulled as they go along. Mm. And I took offense at that as well, so I decided, you know what? What would it be like if magic was taken away from an individual and placed on items that could be moved around? So this whole idea of having all the magic spells in Dungeons and Dragons as put on masks that you could collect and change as you're fighting was an idea that I put to my party, and it was actually really fun, because what would happen is that you have this incredible dance of steel and spells, and I think that's kind of the basis of where Masquerada came from. Layered on top of that, I have fond drunken memories of sword fighting with wooden swords in Venice, and that kind of added to the aesthetic of what became of Masquerada.
Wait, actually in Venice? You were actually fighting with swords in Venice?
Yeah. So I was backpacking around Venice, and I was actually hanging out with a bunch of Australians, and we got drunk all the time. And we
that sounds about
shit.
Right. That
yeah.
sounds
so
about right.
We
yeah.
bought... Yeah, so we bought a bunch of like wooden swords, and we were fighting along the canals and like chasing each other around.
One of the things is pretty striking about the game is this sort of like almost Renaissance era European influence. But you say you're building a game with shifting power and all that sort of stuff. How have you built out the world, and what are some of the key things that you want to sort of focus on when you're building this world for people to jump into pretty soon?
I think the three main things we wanted to cover with the world is that what happens when power is distinct? Because right in the world today, sure, you have money, you have power, but power is a very intangible idea. But what happens when you actually place it on a thing that you can exchange, sell, steal, and exploit? So that's what the masks are about. Aside from that, we're also exploring this whole idea of mortality, because in this world, where the masks are, because of this craziness or magic, they're all actually, I would say, agnostic to atheists. So they don't believe in any gods, or in that sense, there is no afterlife. So in this world, when you die, they believe that you are gone completely and forever. So the only way you are remembered is in a song. So when you pass away, a song is written for you. Your hopes, your dreams, your memories, everything about you is encompassed in this song, so that the people that come after you can find out who you are. And that's quite bittersweet already. But on top of that, the only way you get a song sung for you is that if you have a mask. So only the very rich are remembered.
It really sounds like there's basically an arms race that's kind of set up in this society, and that, you know, and because of the trading nature of, you know, power moving around, so stuff, it sounds like a really sort of unstable sort of situation. I mean, when you're writing in your characters, are you writing a world that is like on the edge of a precipice or in peril at all times? And are people stressed out, or are there some people who just choose not to play the game and just go about their lives?
Well, I mean, the plot of the story takes you to the city 5 years after an actual uprising where the common folk decided that they're tired of being pushed around. So that uprising was quelled, but there's what you see when you enter the city is the repercussions of a city trying to recover 5 years after a giant rebellion. And that plays towards all your characters and how they react to things. And you can even see some of the city folk kind of just, accepting how things are. You know, one thing is that when you're facing a very horrible situation, you tend to normalize around it, and you kind of see this happen in the city. And I would also say that your character, Cicero, the player character, he has a past, and he actually played a big part in what happened 5 years ago, and you're coming back after being exiled for your actions 5 years ago. So we kind of see how that plays out as well.
How do you decide what to show of a character's past? Like, is most of that playable, or is it through cutscenes?
Actually, so one of the things we think about is that how do we showcase our personality? It is mostly in how we react to what's happening today and how we reference what happened before, and that's how we do it. We play Cicero in situations where, you know, we dig at the raw bits of him and we see how he reacts. And I think that's how, you know, it's very natural in how we usually do it as people. And we go through those observations of his personality. So we don't outright. So it's not about plot. It's about character.
One of the things that you've got, which is quite a draw card, is you've got a strong voice cast. You've got people like Jennifer Hale, and you've got Felicia Day, and all these people on board with the project who are kind of helping out to build out these characters. How did you make that happen? That seems to be quite a task to achieve.
Well, I'll put it this way. I've always told people that if I were a D&D character or a role-playing game character, like, my luck stat is to the max. It was really sheer luck. I tell you this much. Okay, let's talk about Jennifer Hale, right? So we randomly met a voice...
Let's please do that.
Voice,
that's awesome.
Yeah. We randomly met a voice director at one of the game developers conferences. And we were talking to him over Skype and deciding, how do we cast this game? How do we figure out what we're going to do? And I was just musing and go like, it would be really good if we could get Fem Shep to come aboard to do a voice. And he goes like, oh, Jen Hill? Yeah, she's my neighbor. No problem.
What? That's awesome. That's the greatest story
ever.
Silliness
like that. And another thing that we did very differently in the development of our game is that we wrote the script and the story before we made the game. So that means that when we went to approach all the voice actors, they actually had something to chew on. They knew what they were getting into. And, you know, it's something that they actually cared about, to the point where I think the rates that they gave us were ridiculously low for, a project of this scale. And I think, like I said, that's really due to luck and the way things are going, back then. And I would also say that because we wrote it first, right, they had a chance to fall in love with the characters, and that added so much to it.
So did the characters change at all after you figured out that such a high-profile talent was going to voice them, or did they stay largely the same?
Largely the same, actually, because what happened was that because they had so much time to sit down and kind of get to know the characters, they decided that they really liked who the characters were and who they became in the game, because we believe very much in character development. Another unique thing that we did with regards to the voice cast is that we did something very different from the rest of the industry. We recorded it ensemble. So Michael Surix, the voice director, decided that he wanted something very naturalistic where everything felt properly conversational versus a man in the booth. So we actually put everybody that had conversation together in the same booth, and they acted off each other. And you can hear it in the acting.
Wow, I know very little about the industry, but I know that's very difficult to do.
Yeah, scheduling was a nightmare, but totally worth it.
Look, you've talked about having a lot to prove, and that you want to, you know, sell Singapore as part of the world, as part of the creative industry, and dispel some of these misinformation that's kind of sitting there. What's been the reaction from your, you know, friends and colleagues and family members and peers inside of Singapore?
I got an email randomly from a guy who was watching stream that I was on, and goes like, "I heard your accent and I knew you were Singaporean, and I just had to email you to say, you know, I'm so glad you're doing something. Nothing interesting comes out of Singapore." And, you know, things like that, you know, that little bit matters. And when we did a Kickstarter, 30% of the backers were Singaporean. And when I say that, that's a large amount. That means it's bigger than my, you know, all our own personal circles of, you know, friends and family. So it was heartening to know that whatever we were doing meant something to people outside of our circle. It was fun because I think on the last day of Kickstarter, okay, so we had supper, myself, Brian, my business partner, and we had supper with our friend Inch Chua, who sang for the game. We actually got a local artist to sing the theme song for our game. She wrote it as well. So we're very used to hanging out with her and people coming up and asking for an autograph and a photo, blah, blah, blah. But this time around, we're eating, and this guy comes out and taps me on the shoulder and goes like, "Hey, are you from Witching Hour Studios? And is this kid from a junior college?" And I go like, "Yeah, I thought he wanted to speak to Inch, and it turns out that he's actually one of our backers." How random is that?
Wow.
You know, the chances of that happening. So it's amazing how much local support we have. And, you know, it goes to prove that all we need to do is just try something versus just complain that nothing's happening, which, as our good old Lee Kuan Yew used to say, we are champion complainers.
What is the environment like in Singapore? We did have you drop out a little bit there, but are you kind of standing there on your own? Are there many other studios that are around? Is it an indie scene? How does it look?
It's quite vibrant, and there are many indie companies here in Singapore. I'm actually part of the International Game Developers Association board here, and we run events where we all kind of chuck everybody in the room and share our experiences and the knowledge and things like that. So yeah, there is quite a lot of movement in the indie scene here. We've also got big companies. We've got Ubisoft. I think one of the other games are coming out with this really cool game that I think you guys should check out, which is a sound-based horror game.
Sound-based horror game. Sounds terrifying, yeah, actually.
I'm already in.
They recently announced that the public, and it's a really fun thing. So, you know, I definitely want to plug them in, and I will give you whatever you need to make that happen so you guys can see it that when the time comes as well.
That sounds very exciting. But look, you've got your game coming out very soon. It's going to be out in a matter of days for people to be able to play it.
Pretty much.
If people want to check it out and get on board, where's the best place for them to go to before it comes out?
Right. So I think that, I mean, on Facebook, we announced quite a lot of stuff as well on Twitter at Masquerada Game. If you're keen and you can't wait, and you really can't wait, it's available on Steam right now. And the Steam version is going to get updated to have all the same content as the PS4 one also. So if not, check out our website, witching-hour.net, so you can find out all the silly things that we tend to do.
Sounds really good. Look, we've kind of hit the end of the show, so it's been really fascinating chatting to you, Ian. We're very excited to check out your game when it comes out on the 8th of August, is that right?
8th of August.
Yep, so very soon on PlayStation, on Steam as well. This has been Pixel Sift. We do this every fortnight. We get developers from, I guess we can say Australasia now, the Southeast Asian area.
Australia.
Can we just start saying all over the world?
All over the world.
Please, thank you.
We'll stretch
this is the
out.
Internet, Johnny.
We're on the internet. We go anywhere. We get, I don't know.
Sweden.
Ken Levine on. Why not? Get him on next week.
I wonder if anyone we know lives next to him.
Oh, do you know him? Do you?
I do actually know him. I can get you his email, actually.
Oh, look, set it us up for everything. Ian, it's been a pleasure. Look, if you want to find out more stuff about the game, we have a website. That website is pixelsift.com.au, but maybe we should go register .com.sg as well while we're at it. And that is where you can find all the links to the things that we talk about on the show. Mitch, where else can people find out information?
Yep, you can go to our website to stream episodes, or you can subscribe to the podcast on either iTunes, Pocket Cast, or using the RSS link on our page. We're also on the Google Play Store. We're also on pretty much every podcast player you can think of.
Very soon to be on a big platform, streaming platform. We'll have some more information about that when that comes online soon.
I was seriously about to say it, and then I didn't because I wasn't sure whether we're allowed to.
We'll wait and
anyway, don't worry about it.
Keep it to yourselves.
Trust me, we'll be bragging all about it when it is there.
When it happens.
Yeah. Nick, we have some older episodes, do we not?
We do, and you can find them on... Ooh, whoops, what have I done? Just shut down my script. Apologies.
iTunes. Pocket Cast. What's Pocket Apple Podcast now? You can find it on our website. You can go on to YouTube or Twitch or any of those other places.
Yep.
I want to say a big thank you to the Murdoch University School of Arts who support Pixel Sift, where you can learn how to make games or radio or podcast or whatever you want. Just search for Murdoch University in Perth, Western Australia. Thanks, Ian, for joining us. We're very excited to check out your game, and we'll see you guys all in 2 weeks' time.
Pixel 2 weeks' time.
It's not Pixel Sieve. Yeah. It's Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sieve!
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.